From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
This morning we begin with a conversation with Professor Kyle Harper from the University of Oklahoma. He's written a history of humans and their germs. His new book is called Plagues Upon the Earth, and it weaves together a grand narrative of global history with insights from cutting-edge genetics. Harper explains why humanity's uniquely dangerous disease pool is rooted deep in our evolutionary past and why its growth is accelerated by technological progress.
And then journalist and author Stephen Kersey, he's the author of The Quiet Zone, unraveling a mystery of a town suspended in silence. Deep in the Appalachian Mountains lies this last truly quiet town in America, Green Bank, West Virginia. Now, it's a place that was once futuristic, and it's also, well, it's old-fashioned. It's home to the Green Bank Observatory, where astronomers search the depths of the universe using the latest technology, while the school children go without Wi-Fi or iPads. Our guest is Kyle Harper. He's a professor at the University of Oklahoma. Kyle Harper, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you. Maybe you can start by telling us why you wrote this book.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm an ancient historian, and I specialize in the study of the Roman Empire. And in my last book, I'd written about a series of pandemics that strike the Roman Empire really at its height and play some role in helping to weaken and destabilize the Roman Empire. And this just got me fascinated with the history of infectious disease and the really powerful role that plagues seem to have played in our past. And so I started in 2017 writing a book on the history of infectious disease and pandemics, and it seemed like a nice, important historical topic, and obviously it became a little more urgent. I was about halfway done writing the book when COVID-19 hit. So it wasn't really a book that was born as a COVID book, but it was finished as a COVID book, and I think can at least help us have some deeper perspective on how we got here and why this sort of thing happens.
And Kyle, before we get into it, I get a little confused with what these different pieces are. And help me. An epidemic is a disease that affects a whole bunch of people within a community or a region, and it can spread to multiple countries. A pestilence is a fatal epidemic, something like the bubonic plague, and a pandemic is an epidemic that is prevalent over the entire country or the world. Is that correct?
That's pretty good. These are actually kind of loose terms, even though they sound scientific. There's actually some kind of fuzziness in their definition. And pestilence in particular is just a common word meaning any kind of deadly disease outbreak. But epidemic and pandemic are interesting words because an epidemic is a sudden, large increase in the prevalence of a disease in a population. And a pandemic just means a really, really big epidemic. It's no more technical than that. And in fact, it's in the 19th century when people have, for the first time, they have telegraphs and you have really global networks of communication that people are able to see disease outbreaks happening all across the globe at the same time. And so there are really big outbreaks of cholera and influenza in the 19th century that sort of give pandemic its modern meaning of a epidemic so big that it crosses continents.
Kyle, you know, it's interesting you say that you were already writing this new book, Plagues Upon the Earth, when COVID struck. We had just spoken to another person who writes on pandemics, Mark Honigsbaum, who wrote The Pandemic Century. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but we had spoken to him literally just like 4 months before when he came out with his book, before the pandemic. And so, you know, what I'm seeing here, and I've heard a lot, is that there were many, many people who look at the history of pandemics who pretty much predicted or said it's just a matter of time before a pandemic hits. What would you say about that?
I totally agree. And in retrospect, it's sort of easy to see the warnings that we had. And when I started writing the book, one of its goals was to be a warning that would say this is a really fundamental pattern of history, and nature doesn't stand still. Evolution is constant, and so new microbes are always trying to infect humans, and there are so many of us, and we're so interconnected that this was inevitable. So I think historians saw that, but particularly microbiologists and public health experts had been warning us for over a generation, and we were simply complacent.
Yeah. Well, it's a shame now as we look back at it, but, you know, it's so interesting to hear you talk about the parallels, of course, and I know you've been asked that a lot since the pandemic, but the parallels between sort of these plagues that existed throughout the Roman Empire and, you know, the subsequent fall of the Roman Empire and now. And, you know, so much of it, as you explain, has to do with a prosperous civilization. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think we have a natural tendency to think that pandemics or pestilence is a thing that happens when things are going wrong. But in fact, one of the paradoxes of history is that big infectious disease outbreaks really often happen when societies are most flourishing. And actually, from a biological perspective, that makes sense, because what causes infectious disease? Little microparasites, little invisible germs, viruses, bacteria, protozoa, and so on, that are really parasites that are taking advantage of us as the host. So they want to steal energy, and they're just trying to pass on their genes to future generations. And so if there are more of us, and we're more interconnected, and we're living in bigger cities, it actually makes us easier to exploit. And so a really fundamental pattern is that as human societies grow and population increases and cities get bigger and denser and trade networks expand, connecting populations, this helps create conditions in which really dangerous epidemic diseases can spread quickly. So we can think of, paradoxically, pandemics as much as a consequence of our success as it is of our struggles or failures.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Professor Kyle Harper. He's from the University of Oklahoma, and he's written a book titled Plagues Upon the Earth. And I wanted to ask you something very unique about our humanness, our human cells. And I don't know, you hear a lot of different numbers. I've heard one number, 37 trillion. And then we have this non-human half, which is maybe 37 trillion bacterial pieces to our humanness. And then when you take a look at our DNA, we find that over the years, some percentage, it might be 8 to 10% of our DNA is made up or as a result of the bacteria that has influenced our evolution. How does that play into this disease pool that is out there that we're competing with, that we're sharing the world with?
Well, it does matter, and I think in a couple of ways. One is we just have to recognize that microbes are all around us. So viruses and bacteria are pervasive in the world and in and on and around our bodies. And the vast majority of microbes do nothing to hurt us. Some of them, particularly the bacteria that live in and on us, are actually really important partners in maintaining our health. So they're symbiotic organisms that are part of what we call the human microbiome. And particularly in our digestive canal, they play a very important role in maintaining health and balance in our bodies. And they help us digest food, but they also play a protective role because they don't like other microbes. So when we think of microbes, we just need to realize that only a tiny, tiny subset of them are actually really dedicated to a lifestyle that causes harm to the host. So those that do that, that cause a disease, we call pathogens, which is just Greek for causing disease. And they're kind of a small, highly specialized subgroup within this much bigger microbial world that plays a very important role in the health of the environment and the health of soil, and even in the health of our bodies.
Boy, you know, Lynn, we know that Kyle can write, and now we know that he can be a good professor. I mean, I wish I had you as a professor when I was in school, because our show is for curious lay people, and you speak to the curious lay person. And I had professors that, you know, they were really in the weeds with this stuff, and nobody could understand them. But I think in the last 5 minutes, I've come to understand a bit I didn't before. So thank you for that. And when you look at gut health and what are the prospects as we've just started to scratch the surface on learning about the gut mind connection?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that we're scratching the surface. And obviously, I'm a historian. My daughter likes to point out that I'm not the kind of doctor that helps people. But I have a huge interest in biology and microbiology in particular, and fascination with the role that bacteria play in both health and disease. But I think you're right to say scratching the surface, because we're learning so much so fast about how complex the physiological relationship is between the human body and the microbes that are in and on and around us. And so we are learning that just in general, there are a lot of connections between the gut and the brain, but that the chemistry of the organisms that live on us and their metabolism can really affect our human physiology. So it's an amazing thing just to think about how the world is pervaded by systems of organisms at different levels that are intricately dependent on each other.
So, Kyle, you are a professor of classics and letters at the University of Oklahoma, and then you have sort of this other life that, you know, this historian who studies plagues. It's really fascinating. It must be kind of a fun interplay. You must never get bored, let's put it that way.
It's hard, yeah. I've been studying infectious disease has just been, for me, just super fascinating and personally rewarding. Just the sort of basic curiosity that you get to kind of pursue in studying the microbes that cause disease. I mean, they're really fascinating, and I hope I reflect a little bit of that in the book, but there's just so much, to me, just like the basic science of how the organisms that cause malaria or tuberculosis or measles or smallpox or plague, how they work is so fascinating. Evolution is really weird and really amazing. And all of the organisms that cause disease in humans are really, really different. And I think there's just some intrinsic human curiosity about trying to understand them.
Well, it's interesting because while you're doing it as an expert and a professional, most of us have become armchair epidemiologists and microbiologists in the last, you know, 20 months or so, right? And and one of my theories as that armchair expert is that, well, and this is a big question, and it probably repeats itself in history to a certain degree, but here we are, you know, 18, 20 months into this pandemic. Many of us are vaccinated, others aren't. One thing is for sure, that we haven't really been sick in the last 18, 20 months, right? And our immune systems haven't been made to function to fight off disease because we've been sanitizing and masking and all of that. And I'm wondering if, as a society, as you know, as the world here, as a globe, are we leaving ourselves more vulnerable to more disease?
Well, let me first put a very personal spin on that, because I'm a father of four, and three of the kiddos are in elementary school. And we did the online schooling for a year, and we're very strict and isolated. And they went back to school this fall with masks. And you had three kids going back into an elementary school population that had been, you know, held out for 15, 16 months from almost any direct exposure to that many kids their age. So I can tell you, here's some armchair epidemiology / parenting. those first 3 weeks were brutal. They seem to have made up for lost time and gotten every cough, cold, sniffle, and tummy bug known to man. We must have personally funded the COVID testing industry for a month, because we were constantly seeing if it was COVID, and it wasn't. But of course, you know, that's what happens when you bring groups of people together. They're going to exchange germs. And so I think we're actually living through a really strange natural experiment in infection and immunity. We've seen these little spikes of kind of, you know, modest diseases that aren't killer but are still kind of severe, like respiratory syncytial virus, RSV. Mm-hmm. And the big question really looming out there is influenza. How are the COVID-19 and influenza dynamics going to overlap and push against each other? So we're living through this really, really weird experiment, and I think there'll be a lot of opportunity to study some of these things. You know, what happens when you kind of take us out of the circulation systems that we're used to, where our immune systems are getting a lot of these little respiratory and diarrheal diseases? Does it have any really long or medium term impact, or is it just sort of when you go back to life and to school, you're probably going to get some minor but unpleasant bugs?
Well, I remember about 20 or 30 years ago when New York started that I Love New York advertisement, trying to bring people to the state and to the city. And they'd show pictures of Niagara Falls, and they'd show all these different, and they'd show the skyscrapers and everything. I think that their new marketing should be, boost your immune system, come to New York, ride our subway system for an hour, and totally prepare your immune system for the future.
Yeah, get everything at once.
Get everything. I mean, you've got to believe that all you have to do is hang out for an hour in one of those subways and just hold on to one of the rails and just breathe and everything. I mean, you will be prepared forever.
I know. I was a germaphobe before I wrote this book, so even even the idea of holding the rails always makes me cringe a little.
Yeah, you know, and I have a friend that was a germaphobe before COVID, and he's probably listening right now. And about 10 years ago, he started fist bumping. He wouldn't shake hands. And since the COVID thing, he air fists from about 10 feet away. It's a fist bump. It's like, you know, it's through the air. And
yeah,
it's a brave.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see if it permanently changes our greetings. And I love fist bumping. Obama was the first one to make fist bumping socially acceptable, but COVID's obviously given it another level. But you can kind of tell, like, there's levels of greeting. Like, you know, on a campus, the faculty tend to be very, very COVID, you know, hesitant. And so there's a lot of even elbow bumping now, and then the air fist bumping, and then there's fist bumping, and then there's the people who still just shake hands and trade each other's germs. So we now live in a world with different levels of greeting.
I'm a hugger, so I'm probably in trouble. But anyway, I did want to ask you this, a serious question, and that would be, well, my marketing idea for New York was serious, too. But I wanted to ask you, how has this disease pool that is evolved with us, how is that accelerated by technological progress?
Well, this is one of the big themes that I try and get at, is that one of the things that really makes humans unique is that we have the brains to build technologies that let us grow and multiply. And so the reason why there's 8 billion of us and there's only a few hundred thousand of any other primates, like the chimpanzees or other great apes, is because we have technologies. And so we create technologies that allow us to get energy, feed ourselves, and multiply. And so in a way, the story of humanity is the story of our technological progress and multiplication, but that those same forces that allow us to grow and multiply and be more connected always play into the hands, or I should say, to the advantage of our germs. And so there's this pattern of history in which humans develop some new technology that changes the way we live and often makes life better or more secure, but it also brings in its wake new trouble, different kinds of diseases. And so, for instance, one of the big stories in history is the rise of farming and the transition from hunting and gathering to sedentary farming. And this is in some ways a very positive technological innovation, new way of getting food, and allows humans to grow and multiply. But it also clearly brings with it huge numbers of new diseases. So that's a really important thread of human history, and it's really the key to understanding why we have so many nasty infectious diseases.
Oh, it's just a fascinating study. And I'm wondering, as a means to sort of wrap up the interview and let you get on to teaching your class that you thankfully postponed for 10 minutes or so to do this interview. Thank you for that. You know, knowing what you know about history and the evolution of disease and the evolution of our DNA, what do you predict, if you're able to, you know, is what the fallout is going to be from this pandemic, and what do you see for the future?
Yeah, I mean, historians are more comfortable looking back than looking forward, but right. you obviously want to be able to, it's important to try and understand where we're going, and knowing where we've come from helps. And I think the big question that we all need to be, well, there's two big questions we need to be concerned with. One is, are we really entering a new period where diseases are going to emerge faster? Because it seems like there's evidence that supports that very scary idea. There have been a ton of near misses from Ebola and Zika and West Nile and SARS-1 and MERS, all of these that sort of threatened in various ways to become even bigger than they have been. And then, boom, COVID-19. So COVID-19 doesn't come out of the blue. And we need a lot of work really trying to help us understand where are the hot spots, how can we do better to identify earlier where new diseases are going to come from, because there clearly are going to be new diseases, and the future might be one in which we're really entering a phase where we face a number of really grave challenges. And then the other is more social. I think when we have historical perspective, we'll really, even more than maybe we already do, see how much amazing scientific progress has been made in the last few years. The development of 3 safe and effective vaccines, 2 of them on a novel platform, mRNA, the rise of faster and better viral therapeutics and testing. There's a great burst of innovation. I mean, think of how much human genius is focused on COVID-19. But our social response is very disappointing. It's become too polarizing, too confusing. There's a lot to that. It's political, it's social, it's technological, it's social media. And so I think as a historian, the societies that confront the challenge of disease well always have good science and good social coordination or cooperation. So our scientific response kind of gets an A+, and our political and social response is kind of a D. So how do we address that? Because there will be another pandemic. We don't know when, but this is a great opportunity, and it's imperative that we learn from the successes and failures of this one.
Kyle Harper is professor at the University of Oklahoma. He has written Plagues Upon the Earth, Disease, and the Course of Human History. Kyle, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Now, what if there were a place where you could digitally disconnect for good? I think a lot of us would enjoy that right about now. No social media, where people weren't constantly scrolling on their cell phones, where forest hikes weren't ruined by a ringtone, or where getting lost meant really getting lost because a gadget or GPS wasn't going to rescue you. Our next guest, Stephen Kersey, has written a book about one such place. It's a small town in an isolated corner of Appalachia, Green Bank, West Virginia, where electronic noise is tightly monitored and restricted. Why? Well, Stephen Kersey joins us to tell us after writing a book on the subject of this curious little town. It's called The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. Stephen Kersey, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn and John, it's great to be here. Thanks for bringing me on.
A lot of us, upon reading the title and the tagline of your book, would think that it's an ideal that we will be striving more and more to attain. But tell us really what's behind this quiet zone.
So back in the 1950s, 60 years ago, the National Science Foundation decided that America needed a really big investment in radio astronomy. This was a fairly new branch of astronomy, only founded in the 1930s, sort of by accident, when some engineers essentially started realizing that their antennas, their radio antennas, were picking up extraterrestrial static, you know, from the cosmos, radio waves coming in from the far reaches of space. And this developed into a science called radio astronomy. And it was deemed that Green Bank, West Virginia, would be the best place in the eastern United States to host a major national facility with a handful of radio telescopes. It needed to be in Green Bank in West Virginia, in the remote mountains of West Virginia, because this was deemed to be like the quietest place, perhaps, on the eastern, in the eastern United States for these telescopes to be. Radio astronomy needs to be done in a radio quiet place, because you don't want to have a whole lot of radio static interfering with what those telescopes are picking up, in the same way that you don't want to have, you know, optical telescopes in the middle of a bright city where you have lots of light pollution all around you.
Tell us just how remote and how sparsely populated this place is. I think we in the West think of, you know, the West would have been a good place to put it, because, you know, it's very sparsely populated out here. But tell us about this area of Appalachia. And by the way, is it Appalachia or Appalachia?
I think it depends where you are in Appalachia or Appalachia, and you ask that question. But people in the Green Bank area call it Appalachia, and that's why I refer to it as well. So there are probably plenty of places in the western United States that could have been the host for this radio astronomy facility as well, but they wanted it to be close to Washington, D.C., where the National Science Foundation is based and where a number of universities were located as well that already had a number of scientists involved in this field of radio astronomy to make it easier for them to visit those telescopes and get back and forth. Green Bank is in the middle of Pocahontas County. This is a Rhode Island-sized county. It's massive, and it has no highways going through it. It's about two-thirds federal or state forest. Today, it only has about 8,000 people. There's only one high school, I think three elementary middle schools. There's one newspaper. There's not a whole lot there. It's minimal industry. Back in the early 20th century, there was a real burgeoning or real booming logging industry, which kind of went bust when all the trees were cut down. So all that industry kind of, you know, faded by the time that the astronomers came into town in the 1950s. It was mostly just pastoral land and a couple loggers remaining, and just, you know, people going to school and having small jobs in other ways. So it's very much naturally quiet. It's also in the Appalachian Mountains. It's in this 4 mile long kind of valley surrounded, I think it's at about 2,000, 3,000 foot elevation, but it's surrounded by mountains that go up to about 5,000 feet. So it's this perfect spot. It's like a natural bowl. And those mountains both keep out the outside world's radio waves, but they also keep out the outside world's kind of ideas and influence in a lot of ways. It's not an easy county to get into. If you're there, you were probably born there, or you really want to be there, but you don't get there accidentally for the most part.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with Stephen Kersey. He has written The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. And there are a number of characters and strange organizations, and they don't text each other, so they've got post-it notes that they hand each other in the post office or in the general store. But also, William Pierce, who is the person that put together the National Alliance, which is a neo-Nazi organization, is in that county. Are they actually in that town, or are they just in the surrounding county somewhere?
Yeah, they're about 30 miles south of Green Bank in that county of Pocahontas. In a lot of ways, this is like a town-sized county because there's so few people. There's only one high school, and they're all connected, really, by the newspaper, by the education system, by everybody kind of going to the same general stores and rubbing elbows with each other. And so William Pierce, who was not just any neo-Nazi leader, he was leader of America's once preeminent, best organized, most influential neo-Nazi organization through the 90s and early 2000s. Also, he was the author of an infamous novel called The Turner Diaries, which the FBI has considered and called the Bible of the racist right. It's been behind dozens of acts of deadly far-right terrorist violence worldwide, most notably the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. The perpetrator, Timothy McVeigh, was actually found with that book in his car with passages underlined. And he was known to really pass around that book and consider it like a real motivating text for himself, along with other far-right figures who have cited that text. And he's based there in the Quiet Zone, just south of Green Bank, for many of the same reasons that drew in the radio astronomers. He wanted to get away from it all. William Pierce wanted to get away from minorities and law enforcement and civil rights groups. He wanted to be able to retreat to a remote mountain holler where he could buy a lot of land for really cheap and get away from it all and pursue his own kind of fringe ideas. And in a lot of ways, that's also what drew the radio astronomers out there to this quiet place. They could pursue their own kind of like, you know, quirky branch of science, radio astronomy, without being bothered by the outside world's noise.
Stephen, you and I were speaking in the virtual green room before the interview started, and we were both telling each other how we had not heard of this place, and you've now heard of it much longer than I have, but I just heard of it just a couple of days ago when Lynn and I were talking about the book. So I would assume there's a lot of other people that haven't heard about it. At the same time, I've met so many folks who feel that they're sensitive to some of the new technology, specifically 5G that's coming out. They feel, you know, that that's a problem for them. So I suspect, one, your book's going to get a lot of buzz, and two, there might be a land grab going on in that county if there are opportunities, because there are a lot of people that would like to be in that sort of environment. What are your thoughts on that?
John, you're absolutely right. There is actually a land grab happening there by people who are trying to get a piece of that quiet. I've been in contact in the book and since the book came out with probably the major realtor in that county. His name is Oak Hall. And it's just been soaring real estate values, especially from out-of-staters, trying to come in there because they want a piece of quiet. Probably because of the pandemic, they want to get away from cities and have a big piece of land for a cheap value where they're kind of away from a lot of other people's influence. But then there is quite a few of people known as electrosensitives. These are people who actually feel physically allergic to Wi-Fi and cell service and other forms of modern electromagnetic radiation that are coming from electronic gadgetry all around us, be it your microwave or your stove or your refrigerator. And hundreds of these people have come into the Green Bank area because they believe it's like their last refuge in a noisy world where they can be free of the pain. So much so that land values are booming in that area because of the electrosensitives who are coming in. That realtor, Oak Hall, told me that 10% of all his land sales, about 200 homes over the past decade, have been to electrosensitives or people with concerns about electromagnetic sensitivity and trying to get away from that.
Stephen, there's a bit of a push-pull right now in this area, in the quiet zone, those who want to really maintain the electrosensitives, right? And others who want to maintain the quiet zone. And then there are others who are striving to move into where technology is accessible. And surprisingly, and what the media has reported on in the past is not really accurate, that there, what you report on now is that there is Wi-Fi and people do have cell phones, whether or not they get a signal or whether they're constantly walking around searching for a signal is another part of this story. Can you talk about that?
Before I went to Green Bank, I had expected to find a place that was basically offline. Headlines about this place range from the land where the internet ends to the town where smartphones are banned to the place where Wi-Fi is illegal to even the observatory itself having t-shirts that say, "Welcome to the quietest town in America." You know, you're surrounded by 13,000 square miles of quiet. So I went in there expecting to find a place where not only people would not have smartphones and Wi-Fi, but where they would kind of share my own philosophical aversion to these devices. I myself haven't had a cell phone since 2009. It's like a personal choice that's kind of evolved into an obstinate refusal. And I thought going out here, I'd, you know, find my people. And it didn't take very long before, yeah, everybody seemed to have a smartphone. I remember going into a classroom at the elementary school and third graders and asking, who here has smartphones? Every single hand went up. The first time I actually went into the middle school, an eighth grader was in trouble for setting up a hotspot, a Wi-Fi hotspot. He kind of hacked into the computer's, into the teacher's, his teacher's system. And that's really a problem because the school abuts the astronomy observatory itself. Like those soccer fields behind the school, they just basically look up at the massive Green Bank telescope. It's like 500 feet tall. It's right there. And so to have a hotspot at the school, it's very much impacting the astronomy work being done there. But it's not just the school that occasionally has a hotspot. I did a drive around with the quote unquote quiet zone cop, this guy who drives around this truck, and it's got like 17 antennas coming out of the top, and they act as a direction of finding array to allow him to track down sources of renegade radio frequency interference. And before we even got into the parking lot, I think we picked up 6 Wi-Fi signals like right across the street. Within a 2-mile radius, we picked up more than 100 Wi-Fi signals. And since the pandemic, we were talking about that boom of people coming in. You know, a lot of these people coming in, they want to have Wi-Fi. If they're not electrosensitive, but it's also more people working from home these days. And so they want to have more technology and they want to have Wi-Fi as well for their work. And so it's now nearing 200 Wi-Fi signals just within a several mile radius of the observatory. That's a problem for the science. And it's also a problem for the electrosensitives who are coming here just trying to like grab onto one of the last quiet pieces of America.
Wow, that's fascinating. It would seem that if you're moving into this very isolated spot, you're sort of moving in there with this agreement that you won't engage technology in this way, especially because this Green Bank Observatory, the success of what it can, you know, what it's doing depends on not having radio frequency or Wi-Fi sort of interference, right?
Yeah, there's a lot bundled in that, you know. So people moving in, yeah, you would think that they know what they're getting into, especially electrosensitives, since they're actually fleeing the radio noise. But if you're born there, or if you're a kid raised there, like, did you choose not to have Wi-Fi, or did you choose to live in a place where there's these restrictions on it? No. And so for them, it's like, well, I want to have it. And why should I have to sacrifice what I see everybody outside the quiet zone being able to have? And there's a real sense being there of that tension. I remember being at the local general store one time and speaking with a father and son, Matthias and his dad, Daniel. I had already spoke with Matthias before, and he very much told me, like, don't have a cell phone, never had cell service, never missed it, and we don't have Wi-Fi at home, he told me. And then a couple months later, I saw him and his dad at that general store again. I was like, hey, do you guys still not have Wi-Fi? Because I've been growing skeptical after doing those drive-arounds with the Quiet Zone cop. And they're like, nope, no Wi-Fi. And I look at them like, really? Because I think everybody else has it. And they kind of looked at me and they looked at each other and kind of like sheepishly grinned. And then the dad, who's actually a minister, says, actually, we do have Wi-Fi. So here's like a man of God lying to me, breaking one of the Ten Commandments, you know, about whether or not he has Wi-Fi. What other town in the world, right? Or do people feel ashamed? Like they need to hide whether or not they have Wi-Fi in the house. So I asked the dad, why'd you lie to me? Why didn't you want to be open about it? And he says, well, the observatory provides a lot of jobs in the community that are big economic importance to this area, and that doesn't have a whole lot in it. It's more than 100 jobs. It's millions of dollars of economic input. But then the dad added, but when the fast lane is going 75 miles per hour, that's the lane you have to be in. So for him, it was a sense of he had to have Wi-Fi for the sake of his kids, for them to have educational benefits, perceived educational benefits from Wi-Fi, and just to be able to give them the access to the online world that the outside world has.
Our planet is very noisy. It's also very loud. I think the noisiest place on the planet might be in northern New Jersey. You've got the 10 million people from Manhattan, and you've got all these people from New Jersey. It's just really noisy with all of the microwave and all the radio waves, everything else there. And yet a couple of guys bought this old telescope, radio telescope from Bell Labs, and they set it up in the middle of this noisy place, and they discovered the echoes of the Big Bang, the microwave background that occurred 13.7 billion years ago. Somehow they were able to hear this little thing and then separate all this other data so that they could have this extraordinary discovery. And Lynn and I had a conversation with someone that was looking at neutrinos from a far off star and talking about how noisy the world was. And they've been able to put together, through a bunch of sophisticated algorithms, ways to be able to separate the noise of these neutrinos. Is current technology allowing us to do a better job of that? And does the federal government, that is also doing some spying on their adversaries, are they able to separate some of this noise out of the way so they can get their job done?
That's a question I put to the astronomers and the engineers at the Green Bank Observatory itself. And the response is, yeah, there is technology out there that would allow it, but it's really time consuming and it's really expensive. The Green Bank telescope, which is like the flagship telescope there in Green Bank, it's monitoring the skies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's basically always taking in a massive amount of data. And in order to run that data through like the algorithms and through some kind of filtration system that would separate all the noise, it would be incredibly expensive, and it would also slow down the entire process. And the expense is really a big thing, because already the Green Bank Observatory is fighting for its financial survival. So about a decade ago, the National Science Foundation actually determined that the Green Bank Observatory might not be worth its funding any longer. And it put it up for financial review with the potential to being mothballed, potentially. This is our nation's very oldest national radio astronomy observatory. The Green Bank Telescope is the world's largest fully tellable radio telescope. There's no other as big that can move with 120, 180 degrees and look in all directions of the sky. No other telescope in the world has that capability. So, but nevertheless, the National Science Foundation was saying, we don't think it's worth its, you know, $10 or $15 million upkeep any longer. And so there's a real struggle for survival on the part of the Green Bank Observatory, where only a couple of years ago, they were finally able to get funding secured from the National Science Foundation for another 5 years. So they, you know, they have a lot of other concerns. Like they need to have enough money to pay their staff, to pay their engineers, to pay their astronomers. They don't have the extra budget to invest in a major technology that would allow them to keep out all the noise, that would allow them to filter out all the noise. So very much they're dependent on cooperation from the community to keep that area quiet. And also, I put that question to the principal scientist at the observatory, Jay Lockman, early on in my reporting. He's like, yeah, the technology is there, but if you think about the analogy to drinking water, you know, you don't start with something really dirty, like sewage, and then try and turn it into Evian or Poland Springs. That doesn't sound very appealing, for one. And also, it's just really, really hard and expensive. Like, imagine all the work you'd have to do to get to that. You start with something that's really clean, and then you take out a little bit of something.
Well, that's a really good point, because probably one of the most extraordinary things that's happened in the observing of our universe is the Hubble Space Telescope, which just turned 30 last year. And that's only a couple hundred miles above the Earth in orbit, and has to turn itself away from the infrared that's coming off the planet. And the JW, James Webb Telescope, is slated to launch in early December. Finally, it's a couple years late, but that is going to sit a million miles from Earth, and it's going to be away from the moon, away from the sun, and it's going to have all the sophisticated shielding so it can do the radio astronomy, the infrared, I think specifically in the infrared spectrums. And maybe they can get some time on that. I mean, I don't know. Everybody wants a piece of the James Webb. Everybody wants to point the James Webb in some direction and do something specific. So I think that's probably what's going to be happening in the future, because as you said, it is expensive to take all that chafe and move that out of the way when you're collecting so much data.
I mean, it's a reality that the observatory knows that, you know, it can only, its window into the radio universe from Green Bank is getting smaller and smaller because of the surrounding radio noise. And there may come a day where we just can't do radio astronomy anymore on Earth, where we'll have to set up some kind of telescope on the far side of the moon, right, which has a constant look into the universe without any interference from the United States. But just think about the expense. Like this telescope in Green Bank, it's a 2.3 acre dish. It's the size you could fit two football fields. That's the acreage of two football fields. Like, how are you going to get all those materials up on the moon? You know, how are you going to get them, like launch them out into space and then build some kind of giant canopy or whatever out there that's going to collect those radio signals? Like, you want to have a really big dish to get like a real range of radio signals. And that's really hard to do when you're trying to build a telescope in space. So for now, it's still the case that it's our best option to try and just keep out the radio noise in these radio telescope facilities that are on Earth.
Stephen, before we let you go, and we have just a few minutes left, I wanted to bring it back to the people of Green Bank. And, you know, here in the Park City School District, we boast that we have 1-to-1 computer or laptop to student ratio that starts in, I think, the second or third grade. And some of the, you know, there has been some talk in this community about, is this a good thing? Is this taking away, you know, a more authentic, more organic way of learning and of being? And, you know, as you say, the elementary / middle school in Green Bank is the only school, you know, in the nation without, you know, Wi-Fi, iPads, computer access, all of that. How do you see, and how do they use this as a tool to enrich learning, or do they? And what do you think about that?
So they do have computer access. It just has to be wired. And because it can't be Wi-Fi or wireless computer lane, it makes it more difficult to get all the students at the Green Bank Elementary School on those computers. You know, you can't have a mobile computer lab that rolls into the classroom and they're all connected automatically. You've got to filter all the students through that one hardwired computer lab. And that can make it difficult for testing, you know, for getting all the kids to have computer access and typing practice and all those things. There's a real debate going on, you know, around the world about the benefits or, you know, lack thereof of bringing more technology into schools. And there's quite a few schools that have, you know, done things like ban Wi-Fi and said no smartphones in school and said, you know, maybe we need to rethink this one laptop per child policy. And Baltimore schools actually implemented a similar policy, and they found that kids' test scores went down after having it. You know, who knows what this is? Is this because the technology is bad, or because we're just not quite good at implementing it and, you know, utilizing it to increase test scores and bring those benefits to students? But either way, it's not a panacea. It's not like a golden bullet, or a silver bullet, right? That we bring technology in and things automatically improve. In Green Bank as well, there's a real tradition of oral learning. That's like an Appalachia kind of thing where you tell stories and you talk these things out. And I talked with the math coach for the county, Joanna Burke Kinderman, and she had implemented policies in the schools that kind of got kids more into, you know, squares of learning where their desks sat together and they talked to each other more and they had interactions and they could kind of, like, you know, ask questions. And it's very much not technology based. And so for that area, there was a sense of, like, the technology isn't necessarily good for us. It's not necessarily, like, going to improve things. And we need to work with what we know, which is the storytelling tradition, to try and improve, you know, what's happening here in the schools, be it for math or other grades. And there's also the reality in Green Bank that the observatory is an incredible educational partner. Like, aside from that debate over whether or not tech is good or not to have in schools, like, it's undoubtedly the fact, and every educator I think in the county would agree with this, that having an observatory in your backyard with world-renowned astronomers, PhDs, engineers, having that influence on your school system is invaluable. The elementary middle school's robotics club is coached by a PhD astrophysicist and her engineering husband. They won the statewide robotics competition. A school without Wi-Fi that can't have iPads won the statewide robotics competition. The high school is coached by the software, another software engineer from the observatory. They came in second place in the statewide robotics competition. Like, in a lot of ways, that scientific influence is just invaluable to the community, and they would, the educators at least, would not give that up for the sake of bringing in a little bit more cell service and Wi-Fi.
It is just such a fascinating story. I could keep talking to you for another hour, but we've got to let you go. Stephen Kersey is our guest. He's a journalist. He attended what I know to be the best journalism school in the country, Columbia University. His work has appeared in New York Times, New Yorker, many other outlets. And he does not have a cell phone. That's a whole other part of this story that that we didn't get to, but it's an interesting one. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to talk to you both. Thanks for the thoughtful questions.
And that was Stephen Kersey, author of The Quiet Zone. We hope you enjoyed that previously taped conversation. Also, thanks to Professor Kyle Harper from the University of Oklahoma, his book, Plagues Upon the Earth.